Great. So I get to start out our session. I'm going to talk about PowerShell and Configuration Manager. How many people are using PowerShell today? All right, good. How many people are using PowerShell with Configuration Manager? Great. All right. I'm done with hands, I promise. All right, so I'm going to show you a few things inside of Configuration Manager, actually inside of PowerShell that we can use for Configuration Manager. I'm going to bounce through several demos. And I've got a timekeeper up front making sure I stay on time because I want to make sure everybody gets up here. So first, we're just going to talk about a little bit of deploying software and some of the tips and tricks that I use with PowerShell and Configuration Manager to help me get my job done easier. First, just importing a module. What you can see here is basically we're getting the path to where the module is. Configuration Manager console has to be installed anywhere that you use the module today. So we're just getting that path, and then we're going to import that module. I'm going to connect to the provider. Now let's take a look at all the command lists that are available for us. I'm just throwing this into an outgrid view, which allows us to quickly see some data there. So for example, if I'm looking for application, I can kind of filter pretty quickly and see some of the command lists that are available for me for applications. You do notice that the Configuration Manager command lists use the verb noun as well as the prefix for CM. So it really should help you think type do as you move through PowerShell. I clicked the wrong button. Let's try one more time. Okay, so add deployment type is an interesting commandlet. If you've done anything with Configuration Manager, you're familiar with applications, and there are multiple deployment types that are available to you for Android, iOS, Windows 8, Windows Mobile, all those things. So just really quickly, I wanted to show you some of the help that's here. As you can see, there are a lot of parameter sets that are available for us. I want to look for one that's actually specific to Windows 8. I can actually come into this the show menu and actually find the Windows 8 app installer, which is the parameter set that I want to use. Still a bit of a challenge, though, because when I look through here, I can find what parameters are required and not, but it's still pretty difficult to look through. So let me show you one other way that I prefer to go. And oh, by the way, PowerShell will pay your mortgage. Remember that. So show command is a pretty neat command. This is native to PowerShell. I'm just taking advantage of it with all these parameter sets that we have with Configuration Manager. I'm going to select the Windows 8 app installer, and I'm going to zoom in real quick just so you can see it. So by using this show command, I can actually see the parameter sets, and they're grouped by that tab. So now I'm focused on the Windows 8 app installer deployment type, and I can actually see the required ones by the asterisks. I have one more thing to show you here. I'm going to type in real quick some information just so I can get to the next step. I'm going to say yes, allow for unknown publishers. I have to specify a location. It's a Windows app installer. I also have some optional commands with this commandlet, so I can say to allow clients to use a fallback source. I can also say to download on a slow network, as well as this app, when this app is installed, allow to trigger VPN on initialization. Now, what's pretty slick is I can actually click run and run this commandlet right here. To me, there's more value in copy. And if I just throw this in Notepad real quick, you can see I actually built a command line using show command where I can see all the parameters that are required for me. Makes it a lot easier to get through this process. These commandlets are great, but some of them are pretty long. All right, so let's quickly go through an example of deploying software. I had an example previously that went through all the steps of creating the app and deploying the app. Creating the app and the deployment type. I'll post that on my blog. Just don't have enough time today to go into that detail. So when we deploy an application, we have to deploy it to distribution points first. And this is where we're doing just a start CM content distribution, specified an application name as well as a distribution point group name. Demo guys are not with me, are they? Let's go back. Let's see what we've got. Okay, let's see if we can continue. Start CM application deployment. So we're going to try to deploy a simulation now. And that's going to fail for me too, because we must have deleted something earlier in our code. Anyway, from this, we would deploy content, or sorry, distribute content, create a simulation, because we always create simulations when we deploy applications. And then, let's say 3 days later, for example, you can look at the details of that simulation and decide if you want to move it to production. We don't actually have a promote to production action, but what we can do is we can actually get the details from that simulation stored in a variable, and then you can see we can remove that deployment, and then when we're ready, then we can do a run a start CM application deployment, and when we run that, that'll actually create the deployment for us. Just really quickly, you can see we're doing a couple things with start CM application. We're saying that it's an install action and it's required, as well as a deadline. It's 3 days from today, and the deadline is at 8 p.m. local time. So that's pretty slick. Let's cancel out of this demo. And let me go to the second one real quick. So in this second demo, this is more of a software update type of scenario. I don't know how you do patching in your environment, hopefully with Configuration Manager. But in our environment, especially in the server space, right, we have several patch windows and things like that that we've got to handle. I just want to go through a process of how you can leverage PowerShell to build those collections. So in our environment, we actually query CMDB. For simplicity's sake, in this session, we're actually going to use a CSV. So I just have a comma-separated file that has different server names and has patch windows for each server. So let's run through this demo quick. Again, we're importing the module for Configuration Manager. I'll step through that fast. Quick mention on the pipeline. We're actually going to remove all the collections that start with server patch with this one command. So we're doing a get CM device collection, which will get all the collections. My filter is going to look for the name that starts with server patch. And then we're doing the pipe again and saying remove CM device collection. Now, what's great about PowerShell is that it will do exactly what you tell it to. It will also do what you tell it to very, very fast. So you have to be careful when you're running these types of commands in your environment. Always go to your test lab first. So we removed the collections. PowerShell does give you a lot of free stuff, such as that pipeline. Other things are things like importing of a comma separated. We're going to import that quickly. We're going to use the group object function that allows us to group them, the group object commandlet. So what this does is it takes all those patching windows and gathers up all the servers for each window and groups them, kind of like a group by in SQL. So you can get a count, which is kind of handy for the systems that are going to be in each collection, as well as what I'm going to name the collection. You see it's a date right now. We're going to do a little string manipulation to clean that date up. So this is long, this for each. I'm just going to talk through it quickly, and then we'll run it. So basically, we're going to do a for each on that grouping. We're going to give it a nice name that we're going to actually create the collection out of. Then we're going to say new CM device collection. So we'll create a device collection. We'll give it the name, and we're going to limit it to all systems. We're also going to create a maintenance window. When we create maintenance windows, we actually have to create a schedule first. So this is where you see I'm running new CM schedule. For this one, I'm saying it's a non-recurring schedule, and I'm going to give it a start time of the date time that we've grouped from that CSV for a duration of 5 hours. So I'll have a 5-hour maintenance window. Then we'll run the new CM maintenance window. We're going to give it a little, add a little more to the name. We're going to add maintenance to the beginning of it. And we're going to say this maintenance window only applies to software updates. And then we're going to pass it the collection and the schedule information. Next, the last thing we have to do, we have that list of servers in that group object. We need to put them into a comma-separated type of format so that we can add them to the query-based membership rule that we're going to build. So that's what this little group by does. Next thing we do is we actually build the WQL, which is what's used under the scenes for Configuration Manager. And I'm using this trim in to remove that comma from the end of it. And then once that's done, we actually just run what might be one of the longest commandlets you've ever seen, add CM device collection query membership rule, right? So you run that, and very quickly, you've built a membership rule for each of these. So let's just run that. We'll hop into the console. So we're very quickly going through each of those group bys, creating the collection, creating the maintenance window, and then adding all those systems to the collection and a query rule. So let me flip over real quick and refresh my screen. You see I've got my windows now. They're still kind of populating just because that script ran so quickly. You see we've got a nice name there. We see it's limited to all systems. You can also see we have a maintenance window, which is nice. This is one of the newer commandlets that you have with Configuration Manager. And you can also see it applies only to software updates. So that's a lot of power that we can do in a repeatable, reusable process. Set it, almost forget it, and move on and automate some more things in your environment. I flipped through a slide. I was going to talk about it before I went to demo. Now we finished the demo, and I'll hand to Jason now. Come on up, Jason. Thank you. Jason's one of my good friends. He's a MVP as well, and he's going to talk a bit about management points.
Hi, Kirk. All right, so as a follow-on question to Greg's initial, how many are running SMS 2003? There's got to be one. There's nobody, really? Oh, wait, there's one way in the back. I told you. He's a celebrity. Go talk to him. He's a holdout, so good deal. So as Greg said, my name's Jason Sandys. I work for Catapult Systems, which is a national consulting firm. We do Microsoft and Microsoft only because we love Microsoft. So I'm going to get into a nice topic here, a niche topic, about designing your hierarchies. Now, I don't have any demos, and Johan just called me chicken because I don't have any demos. So that means one of two things. Either my sparkling personality needs to carry my 15 minutes or my content. So I'm shooting for both. Johan will probably tell me later on tonight whether I made it or not. So management point selection. How many of you have more than one management point in your 2012 hierarchy today? A lot of folks. How many of you have had fun figuring out why in the world client X is not communicating with MPY? Right? Should it be everybody? Really what it comes down to is exactly what this slide says. So a lot of people said, great, we have multiple management points in 2012. That means I can put a management point somewhere else. I can get rid of my secondary sites. I can now have those geographically dispersed management points. Unfortunately, that's not the right answer, right? Exactly as this slide indicates. We can't put them in remote locations. Well, let me amend that. We can put them in remote locations, but that doesn't mean the clients over there are actually going to use them. So what are they for? High availability, number one, right? Ultimately, and I'll get into the exact details in a slide here, but ultimately, a client choosing a different management point is completely random, right? You can't plan on affinity, and I'll go into that a little bit also. Crossed forest is also a scenario. But another common place that folks want to put management points is in their DMZ, right? Everyone has wonderful security policies. They have things in their DMZ. A management point in a DMZ is also very problematic, so not a good thing to do. So let's get into a little bit of nitty-gritty here. So first thing, when do clients actually look for a management point, right? This isn't a fire and forget. So most people know CCM setup, right? Our wonderful Bootstrap installer has a couple of parameters, /MP, which we won't talk about a whole lot, and SMSMP. It's actually a property, right? That sets the initial management point. It doesn't set the management point that client is going to use for its life. So when does a client actually look for new management points? The three things on the screen that you can see there. Every 25 hours is really the big key, right? Every 25 hours, if you go into locationservices.log on your client, you'll see it looking for a new management point, whatever that management point may be, in a relatively or seemingly random fashion, something to always take account of. Client agent's time, or startup time, right? That's always a good one, or one that's always going to be there. So going back a little bit to the bootstrapping, so I mentioned we have a bootstrapper for the client installation. We have a bootstrapper also for the management point location. They're kind of similar, right? They're going to get things started, the whole point of bootstrapping something. So this is the first step in the process for a client to actually find its management point. So where does it go? The three things that are on the slide specifically. It's going to look in Active Directory. How many of you don't have Active Directory integrated? That's a good story. Awesome. There was one hand over there. So you can go join the SMS guy, the SMS 2003 guy. You guys got some war stories, I'm sure. So we're going to look in Active Directory. The client's going to query Active Directory. It's going to use a global query to do this, right? So the cool thing about using a global query is we don't really care about what domain as long as it's in that forest. And I'm going to find any available management point that's there. Great. I'm going to use that management point, but I'm not actually going to use that management point for my continued management, right? Like I said, this is just getting the ball rolling. I'm going to use that management point now to query which management point I should use. So follow along, mostly two steps. We can also use the current management point. So if I have a current management point set and I can't get to Active Directory or I can't get to DNS like the slide shows, then I'm going to use whatever I have currently set. And I'm going to ask that, hey, just give me a management point so I can actually look for what management point I'm ultimately going to use. Now finally, we get to that process, and it's called MPList. A lot of folks may or may not have heard this. This is kind of what the developers call it. It's what the API call. If you put into the URL in Internet Explorer, that's what it's going to be called there. So that's why it's called MPList. And it comes down to this simple process, ultimately. So first, am I on the internet? Right, if I'm on the internet, I get a special MPList, right? Because I only want internet-capable management points. I don't even want to try to go to anything internal. If I'm not on the internet, what forest am I in? Or what domain I'm in? So that's a big one. Number three is a huge one. Why? Can anyone say why that one's a huge one? It's too big of a room for me to really ask that one, so I'll tell you. It's not in the documentation today. You're not going to find this domain piece in any of the TechNet docs today. And so I should have filed this one a while ago, but I haven't, so I need to contact SMS Docs and get that one in there. But it will consider the domain as far as the affinity or where the clients are actually going to go. And then finally, it's going to go and look at the internet and the IP address so we can do a few other things. But those are all essentially information that the client itself is sending to the management point. So that's the management point for the Bootstrap, right? That's step one. Let me send all this information up so that now I can figure out exactly which MP that I want to go to or get that MP list back. Now, the management point is essentially going to send two lists back, one for HTTPS and one for HTTP. So the client can now determine which management point that it wants. And the client effectively goes through this process for those two different lists. Now, I had an asterisk on the last list, or at the bottom there on my two lists. I had my HTTPS list and I had my HTTP list. And I've also got an asterisk here next to affinity. And the reason is because, going back to one of the things I said, the internet, if you're an internet client, you don't want to use anything internal. So in that case, they only get one list back of only the available internet management points. But that's another little key piece in here, is that there's still no affinity for the clients to go to internet management points. They will randomly choose between any available internet management point, and they will cycle every 25 hours, just like your internal clients will. So if you put in an internet-based management point in Hong Kong and one in Dallas, and your clients in Shanghai or your clients in Vladivostok or wherever it's at, it's still going to randomly choose between those two management points. There's no control over that. So very similar on the internal side, these two lists that come back, the client is now going to decide which one to use. It's going to prefer the HTTPS clients. Prefer and affinity are two very carefully chosen words here by the product group also, because there's no guarantee that they actually will. Now, I will say, in production and in my lab, I've never seen a client deviate from this. But that doesn't mean they can't, and it doesn't mean they necessarily won't. But in general, and as a rule of thumb, they will prefer an HTTPS management point. So that's one they're going to choose. They're going to choose that list. Once they choose one of the lists, now they're going to say, well, is this guy in my domain? And actually, I guess I should have the sort order there flipped. It should be really domain and then forest, because I want to look at somebody in my domain first, right? Typically, that means that there's no firewalls in between me and that guy, and I have access and a clear path to being able to communicate to that management point. And then we're finally going to fall back to the forest, and that's really where that cross-forest scenario comes in. Once again, this isn't guaranteed either, though. You have to take that into account. And that's why putting these into a DMZ or any type of segregated network, any type of network where it's going to restrict the traffic, is going to have issues potentially, because he's going to reach out and not going to be able to communicate with that MP that's across that network border. Finally, number three is the big one, and this is what's going to happen in most environments, right? Most environments don't have the multiple forests, don't have the multiple domains, so they're effectively going to choose any MP at random. There's no way, and there's no rhyme or reason to actually
figure out which MP the client is actually going to choose. There's ways to kind of game this. Rob Marshall, a fellow MVP, has a tool out there, and he manipulates the hosts file, effectively telling the client that he can't get to an MP and move on, find another MP. It works, but at the end of the day, I don't know, a little bit of a hack, so it kind of depends upon what your scenario is, whether you really want to do something like that and play around with your hosts file. So number four is key also. If I can't get to a management point, let's say there's a firewall rule in place, my DNS is screwed up, right? There's about a million different things on the network side that can cause issues. I'm gonna keep trying that one MP five times. Once I figured out that I can't get to that MP, now I'm gonna rotate on. So that's kind of the worst scenario if I can't get to an MP, and it's something to consider when you're talking about segregated networks. So here's one of our first problematic scenarios that I mentioned. This is the remote, right? This is the total randomness of the MP selection. I can't figure out which MP I'm gonna go to. So am I gonna go across the WAN to hit an MP? That's probably not a good thing, right? You've got a WAN, you're probably paying extra for that. It's probably slower. You don't want all kinds of bandwidth going across it. But there's no way for me to figure out if that client's going across that WAN or not, or going to that local MP. So just don't count on it. Don't plan for that in your infrastructure. If this is truly what you need, then you need a secondary site in your environment. Kind of a similar picture, right? But now we have our firewall in the way. This is our segregated, right? Same thing here. We can't control which one he's gonna go to. So in the case of that bottom path there, he's gonna try. He's gonna try five times if he randomly selects that MP. Once again, he could randomly do this every single day for a year, right? And he's gonna bang against that firewall. He's gonna time out five times. And then hopefully he's gonna randomly select the other MP. Is that a bad thing in your production environment? Depends upon what you're managing, right? It's something you need to be aware of. It's something you need to watch the logs. Make sure that he actually finally does make a connection to that top level MP. But ultimately it's a scenario that has no perfect solution, this segregated network type thing, but it's something to be very much aware of. So like I said, management points in secondary sites are that solution for the remote locations, even though we all hate secondary sites in general, at least I do. Even the product team kind of doesn't like them. But they muddy the waters because now boundaries, there's a lot of verbs on here and different things on here you can go and take into account, read the slides. There's a nice little blog at the bottom there we can talk about. Roaming throws another piece into this. So if you have a CAS, I feel sorry for you to begin with. There are some folks, of course, who can't get away from it, but that's gonna muddy the waters here also because you've got lots of extra boundaries, you've got sites, and now your clients can roam from your North American primary to your, you know, South American or European primary, and so you have to go and figure out exactly where they're gonna go, which management point they're gonna talk to for content, and all of these little things have changed. Really, the moral of the story is MPs are for that, you know, that first slide I had up there, high availability and cross-forest scenarios. If you're trying to do anything else different with an MP, then you're going to run into some weird issues. Follow the logs and you might be able to figure out what's going on, but at the end of the day, it's those other scenarios are not accounted for and you're going to have lots of not fun. And that was my 7 or 8 slides in under 15 minutes. So next we have Mr. Johan, and Johan is kneeling and he will be up here in a minute. Everyone knows Johan, so I don't think he needs an introduction.
All right, thank you, Jason. And since we didn't have enough laptops on the table yet, I decided to bring one more. And I'll steal this area right here to make the AV engineer go crazy, but I'll try to be nice. What can possibly go wrong in a live rig of a system? Let's do this. Thank you.
Should I go up and dance while he's doing that? I can dance.
So it helps. I'm going to go this side. And the right way. All right. How about that, sir? Looks good to you?
Almost.
Almost. Fast, I'm impressed. Done this before?
Once.
Yeah, I've seen Config Manager once too. Whoop. So PowerPoint was number something. I try. That's the one. All right. Welcome to the troubleshooting part. It happens to be, and it breaks my heart to say this, that sometimes things go wrong in Config Manager. And at that point, you have two options. One, and both are acceptable, by the way. One is crying. It helps for a bit. The other one is trying to quickly navigate and solve that problem. And in this session, I will try to give you guys a shortcut or a few shortcuts on how to troubleshoot stuff in OSD with Config Manager. It's absolutely amazing to see 1,000 people in a room joining to see Config Manager stuff. That's so, so cool. Something I would like to recommend before kicking in, and that is, if you aren't using Twitter today, start using it. For me personally, it has become my number one source for information. I follow people that does OSD, that does Config Manager around the globe, and I see what they tweet on a daily basis. It allows me to, within just a few minutes, maybe read through 25, 30 tweets every day and to decide which I would like to read about. And then I maybe read 3-4 blog posts that are related from those tweets. But there is no other technology I've seen so far that so quickly and so efficiently allow me to see what's going on in the deployment world. And sometimes it's been like, don't use this feature. It's broken. And, oh, thank you for letting me know before trying that one out myself. Or this is a new enhancement or a new update that will fix something for you. You will learn that the very same day, often 3, 4, 5 minutes after someone in the world has seen this, and immediately it starts to flow. Social media is powerful. So please get on Twitter, please follow me on Twitter, and please check the people I follow. Geeks like Jason, Kent, Greg, Steve, you'll find those on Twitter as well, and they post on a regular basis. All right. In Config Manager, there will be scenarios where you need to do serious troubleshooting. And the core solution for most of the things, and I talked about this in the pre-conference yesterday, by the way, it's knowing what's going on in Config Manager, knowing the process, in what order Config Manager does things, because that allows you to troubleshoot in the right location, look into the right log file. So you don't spend 2 hours diving through a 200K log file just to realize the error isn't even in that part of the process. So I will show you a few examples there. So jump up to the demo environment. And I'm on, that's Kent. That looks like mine. All right, let's remote into that box. All right, I'm not going to do that, but I'm going to do this. Now, I'm also a master in WordPad. Beside Config Manager, I master two skills, Microsoft Paint and WordPad, and they are really useful when doing presentations. But sometimes when you do Config Manager OSD, you will get an error like this, precisely this error. And this error actually tells you quite much about what's going on, because this error, what it really means is that whatever you were hoping for, you didn't get. And then it all comes down to, all right, it broke. Okay, check, fine, I got it. I got the message. Where do you go in Config Manager? What do? You check the log files. So when doing OSD, where are all the log files? The answer is, it depends. If you're doing a pixie boot over the network, so you go to machine, you hit F12, it doesn't boot. You get the pixie abort immediately. Where to look? Well, the first log file to look is the SMS pixie log file that will be on that distribution point that you connected to at that point. And that will tell you why you couldn't boot pixie. In 11 times out of 10, it's normally because it couldn't find a policy for you, couldn't find a deployment on the server. But it will tell you why. It will tell you what MAC address it found and why it couldn't start the pixie process. So, okay, we assume that you did start the process. So WinP actually booted over the network and you started the deployment. Immediately, it failed and rebooted. That's typically what you will see when you have third-party disk encryption on the machine and Config Manager can't really figure out what to do with it. To prevent that, reboot to help you troubleshoot, because in the beginning, the log files are in RAM. They are in the Windows temp SMSTS log folder. I'm just going to optimize WordPad a little bit here for the 16:9 screen layout. All right. They are in RAM, and if you don't press reboot, press F8 to prevent the reboot, the log files are kind of gone, and you have to try again, and this time press F8 to prevent the reboot. Now, as soon as the sequence formats the drive successfully, they will continue, or it will continue to log the log files or log the information on some local drive, it seems to like for the moment. So it could be this folder, SMS task sequence, logs, or it could be the D drive, or it could be the E drive, because drive letters in Windows PE are temporary. They may not be the same as you have once Windows is up and running. Eventually, the sequence will install the Config Manager client, and once that is done, you will see it start to log the log files in this location to logs and SMSTS login here. And when everything completes, you will see that we'll be moved up one level in the very end and put in this location. So depending on when it fails, you may have to look in different locations for the log files. All right, which log file is the main log file for troubleshooting OSD? And these guys are not allowed to answer. Which log file? SMSTS log, yes. What's the problem with this log file, ladies and gentlemen? The size of it. How big is this log file? 1 + 1 megabyte. Maximum is 1. When it reaches 1, it will create an archive, but only 1 archive. How much content does a normal sequence generate, give or take? 4 megabytes. So now we have 4 megabytes of content. We have 2 megabytes of storage. Do you see any problem fitting 4 megs into 2 meg storage? We can't really zip it. It's simply too big. So the fix is obviously increase the size of this log file. And this is supported, by the way. So how do you do it? All right, turns out to be quite easy. You create yourself a text file, and I happen to have one right here, with the name SMSTS-INI. Because in this SMSTS-INI that you have to create, you can do stuff. So in this example, you can see I have increased the log files to 10 megs. And I have rarely seen a sequence going beyond 10 megs in log files. You can also, and this is optional, this I consider to be mandatory for everybody, but this is optional, the logging level. The minimum in Config Manager is 3, the maximum is 0, the default is 1. So you can increase the verbosity by setting it to none or 0. This one also enables debug logging that will also give you even additionally more verbose logging that can help you troubleshoot. But these guys is normally, all right, if I need it, this one is more mandatory. So this one needs to go into the Windows folder of your boot image. So how do you get that to your boot image? Well, you have a few different options. One, you can find the boot image. You can mount it using ImageX or DISM, and obviously copy the file and unmount it and save the changes. If you do it that way, make sure that you open this WIM file, because there will be two in the boot image. One with a longer name, and that it's bigger, and this one with a smaller name, and the size is smaller. This is the template. Every time you update the DP in Config Manager, it will create the longer name. And if you put your changes in the longer name one, guess what? They are gone. So editing this one. Another option is when you create your boot image, if you're using the MDT wizard with Config Manager to create your boot image, there is actually an option to specify an extra directory to add. And then you simply specify the folder where you have the .ini file, and then it will be added to the boot image as well. And then you can be, it's not really supported, but works. There is a file called OSD injection XML in Config Manager. And that's what Config Manager is using to add files to the boot image. That's why the client is there. That's why the core DLL files are there for deployment. But this is just a text file holding a list of all files that are being added to your boot images. This is an XML file. If you're skilled with Notepad, you can edit this one. You can add your own files to it. If you do, I did say on record that it was unsupported, so don't blame me. And save a copy of the original one. In the very event, you need to revert back to it. All right. Then when you start to do deployments, you have a, for example, I have a good old trustworthy Windows 8 sequence here. If I deploy that sequence and start a deployment and it fails, what happens? You get an error message. And after a specific time, the machine will reboot. How long is that time by default? 15 minutes. This means that if Jason starts a deployment, verify it kicks off, leaves the room, has a coffee with Kent, and they talk football for 16 minutes, and something went wrong in the sequence. The next time Jason goes into the room to check on the deployment, there will be a message for him. Boot manager is missing. Meaning something went wrong in the sequence, the drive was wiped, the machine rebooted, and everything that could help you troubleshoot is gone. So now Jason has to do the following. He has to restart the deployment, wait and stay put for the computer, and try again. I recommend to change that behavior. I recommend to your sequences in the very beginning, add a variable that changes that timeout. This value is in seconds, meaning 24 hours, a full working day. If you have deployment that runs longer than this, you probably have other issues. But my point is this, if you have a sequence or an error in a sequence that is bad enough to break it, you want to know about it. You just don't want it to reboot. You will have a chance to actually catch this one up. So that's something I recommend to add. Then also something I like to add in here, if I troubleshooting, for example, disk part actions, I can see it failed when it tried to do a disk part. Add a pause to the sequence so it actually stops at that point. And in here, I simply added a small VB script that just waits for it to continue, looking for a text file. But this is a great way to making sure that the, all right, the deployment is stopping where you want to troubleshoot. Otherwise, you might miss it. Another thing that is useful, and if I go back to my WordPad that I apparently closed, I can do another one, this one. If you have the MDT integration, which I strongly recommend, by the way. It's not a requirement, but I think it's good. If you have it, you can open that configuration file that you have on your server somewhere in your packet source. Here is mine. Let's see, Windows 8 settings somewhere. This one is extremely useful. Because if you configured that one, what will happen if something fails is that Config Manager or the sequence will now copy the log files to that server share, and it will create a subfolder for each computer that you deploy. And not only the SMSTS log file, if I open up such folder, have a few here, you can see that it's actually gathering quite a bunch of log files that can help you troubleshoot stuff, like this one. That can help you troubleshoot why it couldn't join the domain. If you're lucky, you will get a setup act log file in here. That's the setup main log file, in case the setup failed. And it all comes down to, if you have this enabled, the sequence will gather the log files for you, and you're good to go. Don't have to look for them on the client file. So it reaches out to different locations to make sure it finds the information needed. That can help you troubleshoot. All right, so who are we having up next? Could it be Mr. Denmark? Welcome. Can I leave this here?
Sure. So my mother was certain that I would never make it, and then I now Mr. Denmark. That's pretty. So at least I'm something. Thanks for the introduction, Johan, by the way. Just like what Johan said, please use Twitter. If you have any questions about what I'm going to show you, Twitter might be the best way to ask those questions, unless you want to ask them outside after. And my real name is actually Kent, but you can call me Mr. Denmark. That's quite all right. My session here, my part of the session, is all about collections. And the reason why I've chosen this is for, actually there are two reasons. When I walk into a customer, I often see that they can't really deliver the service that they are supposed to deliver. And the service might be applications, operating systems, software updates, and so on and so forth. And often it's because their collections are designed in a way that looks a little like what we used to do in CMO 7. The other reason why I picked this topic here is because when we changed from Service Pack 1 to R2, one of our applications that we are pre-staging operating systems before we actually go in and install them, and usually that process took like a minute to do, but suddenly we saw that it took up to 30 minutes after we did the R2 upgrade, and we were like, What's actually going on? And we could see the collection evaluator going totally berserk. I don't know berserk if that's an English word, but it means something in Danish. We're pretty busy. So we started investigating that, and that's what I'm going to demo here. So going to look a little at the performance versus the SLAs we have in the organization, setting the business expectations, and then one of the most important things once you've done your upgrade to R2, and everybody should go to R2, is to understand the old systems collection. All of you who are running CM 2012, you know by now that all collections are limited to either a system collection or a user collection. At the top of that tree, we have the old systems and we have the old users. We also learned that limiting the collection, a lot of collections, to all systems is really not a good idea, and especially not in R2. What happens when I update this collection here, if I, let's say, I import a computer object, and then I do an update all systems collection, of course we will evaluate the all systems collection, but we will also look at the collections that are directly limited to that one. So in my scenario, we will also start evaluating the all workstations collection, even though I didn't ask it to do so. It will also evaluate the all server collection. So it just basically goes down the tree. If I imported a workstation, and that workstation belongs to maybe, let's say, the American workstation collection, then it will actually also cause an evaluation of that collection. So any collection that can be changed by the import that I did will be evaluated. Since I imported the workstation, it will actually go ahead and evaluate those workstation collections. And the thing is, I don't control this. It won't evaluate my SQL Server collection because there was no changes in the old server collection. We could kind of control this with the code in Service Pack 1 and also in the RTM version, because when we forced in WMI, when we forced an update of the old systems collection, we could say, please do not do anything on the collections that are limited to you, and it would only update the old systems. that feature is now being deprecated, so it doesn't exist in R2. So what we saw was when we updated the old systems, the collection evaluator did a lot of job, and it took often more than 15 minutes before it actually fell down again, and we could see our device in the collection. So we really need to understand the snowball effects, and then we need to make sure that we don't, in my opinion, we shouldn't create like hundreds of collections that are limited to the old system collection. We need to understand what it does. A few tips and tricks. Greg already showed you a way and a method to go ahead and create collections. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you another way of creating collection. I'm not saying what Greg showed you is wrong. I'm just saying that you should do it my way. No offense. And then, of course, when we are working with collections, you also know you have to know your log files. And there is a new tool in the toolkit called the CE Viewer, Collection Evaluator Viewer. That is really, really important when you want to try and troubleshoot your collection stuff. With that said, let's see if I can hit the right button. And so I could. So the very first thing we want to do in here, and I have a couple of different ways of creating the collections. This is just the basic way. Okay, we could also do it in the GUI, but nobody wants to do it in the GUI any longer since we have PowerShell. So I'm just importing the module, not as fancy as Greg, but it still does its job, and I'm creating a new device collection. Did someone just whistle? Oops, sorry. Yeah, I did. There you go. So the thing is, just like in the first demo, this collection here will end up in the root of my collections folder. A lot of people in this room, a lot of my colleagues, and a lot of the folks that I used to call my friends, they don't like folders. I actually like folders. I don't like a ton of folders, but I like folders that are kind of generic and that we can agree upon that we don't change the folder names because we cannot really control that. I like folders because I can control what's actually going on inside a folder. So for instance, when I created this collection here, I didn't assign a schedule. I didn't assign any incremental updates or anything like that. So right now, this collection doesn't really ever update. The same applies to a lot of the collections that we get over when we're doing a migration. A lot of you guys, you have probably migrated from CMO7. So when you migrated, you most likely migrated your packages, you migrated your collections. And honestly, do you keep track of your collection schedule? Some of you might, but a lot of you do not know when you're actually updating your old workstations collection, when you're updating the Denver collection, and so on and so forth. And if you don't know that, then you will have a, then it's pretty difficult for you to actually honor your SLAs. You can't support, you can't deliver the service that you're supposed to do. So what I like to do, if I just go back here, I have my own commandlet. So this commandlet, what I will do in this demo here first, just create a few collections, but I will add them to a folder that I call Ticket North America. And by the way, the scripts and the commandlets and everything we show, we'll blog about that after the session. Might be tomorrow morning. We have a happy hour coming up here at 6 o'clock, I guess. So, if I just go back into my console, you'll see I have my Ticket North America, and the collections are slowly just being created in here. So I should have four collections all together. There you go. So now I have my my collections. I also have, let's just go back to the icy here. I also have a third way of creating those collections, and that's actually a brand new tool that a colleague and I, Kaido, have been working on for a little while. So this tool here, basically what it allows me to do is it allows me to go in and use Excel to export all the collections from one environment and then have the Excel spreadsheet maybe make a few modifications and then import all of those collections in another environment. The reason why we really like this is we can, it's super easy for our colleagues to go in and say, hey, I want another collection name. It should be limited to this collection. It should belong to this folder. By the way, it's a user collection. And I have a comment, I have a site that it belongs to, and so on and so forth. And over here in my queries, I can go in and add in a query. So I could add in my WMI statement. I could also go in and say, you know what, I just want to add in an exclude collection rule here, and then exclude one of the other collections that I have. So it's going to show you the collections that you have created in the first sheet. So once I have done this, then if I go in and have a look at my code here, this little utility here actually has the import and the export. So see here, if I go all the way down here, import the module, and then just run it, it will figure out that I already have a Vire Monster folder. It's going to create a software update folder, and then it's going to create all of my software update collections. But it's going to place it in a folder that I have decided. So I actually, after that, can go in and create some other commandlets saying, hey, all the collections in this folder should be updated at 8 o'clock every Tuesday morning. So right now, it's just creating my collections. So again, if I go back in here, do an update, you'll see I have my software updates, and it's just slowly creating my entire patch management collection hierarchy, which is extremely nice because some of you are consultants. There, it's very, very nice, and all of you have a test and a lab environment. So this gives you an opportunity to export your collections. So if you go in and delete a collection, you can just run the Excel the commandlet again, and it will only re-import the collections that are missing, because there is no way you will be allowed to do a full restore. Since this is a power session, so I'm going to show you a few other tricks in here. Going into a customer, some customers, they have seen this little checkbox saying enable incremental updates, and then they've just done that on all their collections. So they have that on like 2,000 collections. Before R2, we had a 200 collection kind of recommendation. After post R2, that recommendation has been removed, but still, you don't really want to enable incremental updates on all of your collections. So I have a little PowerShell script here that will actually, let's see where I have that, go in and disable my incremental updates on all of my collections. So when we move into a new site and they have no clue what's going on and we have no clue, just go ahead, disable everything, because now we know it's not enabled anywhere. What I can do after that is I can go in and use my folders in here. So now I have another commandlet that will go in and say, well, on my ticket North America, I want to enable incremental updates, and I also want to have a start time, a full schedule update at 8 o'clock in the morning. And this is one of the reasons why I really like the folders, because I can kind of control that. I feel no pressure, but I can see Peter is pointing at me and saying 2 minutes and 10 seconds. the analyze part, when I start importing a collection, now we need to know if I let me go in here and import a computer. So I'm importing a computer. Once I've imported the computer here, I will do like most people are doing, go to my device collections, do an all systems update. When I do an all systems update in here, if I look at my collection evaluator viewer, you'll see that starting to go berserk in a few seconds. And I will also see in here, in the collection evaluator viewer, I can also get a list of my collections. I can, when I look at the list in here, it will actually tell me the cost that each collection is adding to the system. So the collection evaluator view will not only tell you what collections we are currently updating, but it will also tell you the costs. And this is very, very, very neat. In here I can see 7.5%. I can see I had zero member changes. I actually had zero member changes in most of them. So when I go in and configure my schedule, maybe I should look at the history before I actually start doing that. I can also use this one here to figure out what collections I should actually go in and change. So some of my collections might be extremely expensive when it comes to SQL. So what I want to do is I want to take, I want to grab the guy who's actually responsible for that and say, hey, you need to rewrite your WMI quote because something is definitely wrong in here. These information here are taken from SQL. So a few, and SQL is just a dark hole, so you all know that, it's just a mystery. If you want to learn, you want to know about the DPO collection underscore G, and you also want to learn about underscore L in here, because in here you have all the information that you need. So if you take those information and say, okay, the collection evaluator viewer doesn't really give me any options to export that, then we can take that information, and then we can go back to the first one I showed you here. So in here, when I run my custom commandlet again, what I will actually do is I will take all of my collections that I have, I will export them to an Excel spreadsheet. And for me, in this little demo environment here, it takes about 2 minutes. But it will actually take the information you're seeing in the collection evaluator viewer. So now you have it in an Excel spreadsheet, and you can start making all your calls and say, hey, you need to do some other stuff in here. And just like Greg also did, in my demo here, I used the OutGrid view because I know that would be faster. So here you can see I have my evaluation length, I have my membership changes, and so on and so forth. That's pretty neat, isn't it? Or is it just me that has issues with collections and collection evaluator going berserk? If it's only me, then don't call me if you have issues, because I'll just cause issues, right? But this tool here will analyze your collections. It will give you information about the refresh stuff. You can see the member changes in here. And it's also a backup tool because you can take the very same Excel spreadsheet and then you can run the second part of the commandlet and then import it. So once you have your lab environment, you want to export that and import it in your production environment. And I know you can use the import feature there, but it could be that you're doing it in your own environment and you want to import it in a customer environment. And with that, I think my time is up. So I would like to present the next one up here, Steve. And for those of you who do not know Steve, he's like a living legend, former SQL MVP and now client management MVP. It's
yes.
All yours.
All right, thank you, Kent. Good afternoon. I'm Steve Thompson. I'm a senior system engineer with SoftChoice. And today, I plan on talking about two different things. One is Configuration Manager 2012 backup and restore strategy. The second is PowerShell SQL Server audit. So first of all, with Configuration Manager, there are really two core things that need to be backed up. There are files, and those are packages and applications and content library. The second, of course, are databases and Configuration Manager itself, but often people overlook SUSDB and Reporting Services Database. And out of curiosity, because I saw a show of hands earlier, those of you running 2012, how many are running the built-in maintenance backup task? Can I see a show of hands, please? Okay. How many are not running any backup? Anybody want to admit? That's okay. So the thing is, with maintenance task, the thing that you need to know about that is essentially it takes copies of the database files, doesn't do any compression, moves them over, and copies everything in the inboxes and stores them there. It takes up a lot of data. One of the things that's often overlooked is with Configuration Manager 2012 SP1 and later, is that now we have the ability to do a manual restore of a database in the case of a site restore or recovery. There are other considerations. So for example, if you're using Data Protection Manager, you can also, in fact, you need to do a manual restore. So this, what I'm going to explain about using the various combinations apply to Data Protection Manager as well. Some interesting data points. At my last employer, we had our CAS had approximately 600, get the right numbers here. Our CAS was 542 gigabytes in size, uncompressed. With compression, it got it down to 59 gigabytes in size. And so because of the amount of storage we had, we were able to not back up. We had to back up every other day, otherwise we would overrun the size on the file share. So by using database compression and the native SQL backup, we were able to back up the other databases and store backups every day. So that's a huge advantage. And the other thing, even in this demo environment I'm going to show you, I did a quick test. It's just a simple setup on a virtual machine. And by running the backup task, the maintenance task, it stored over 5 gigabytes of data, and yet just snapping a backup with compression of the databases required for restore, about 300 megs. So, I mean, it's a substantial savings. And then the second part is the PowerShell audit I want to show you. In the first version, PowerShell guru Greg Ramsey helped me, and it was designed to basically detect common configuration mistakes. And we get involved as consultants in looking at a lot of different sites, configurations, and we find common settings, if you will. And so the idea was to have a repeatable process that we could look at the overall configuration of SQL Server, call out particularly database properties of Configuration Manager and others, and also look at some of the performance indicators, such as index creation, statistics, and out-of-date situations that we can then remediate. The script was rewritten, and it can now be run from a workstation. And it was rewritten for, and partly for performance, because of some things that I learned working with PowerShell accessing SQL Server. So, and I'll show that to you shortly. Let's go right into demo. So the first thing we're going to do, I want to show you how to set up a SQL management task. There's been a lot of questions on how to set one up and retention. This is SQL Server Management Studio. I click Maintenance Plans and run the Maintenance Plan Wizard. And it's just basically a click interface. Click Next. And the three things that you're going to want to choose are cleanup history, backup database, and maintenance cleanup task. Click Next again, Next again, and this is the log file. In other words, monitoring the history itself. 4 weeks is fine. Under databases, this is where we can go in and pick the individual databases that we want. So we'll take the Configuration Manager database, Report Server. You always want to get the Report Server TempDB and SUSDB. Click OK again. And then in the folder, I'm going to choose a folder that's been previously defined on D, in my case, backups. And then note, I'm also going to create a subfolder for each database. It makes it easier to locate them when you need to do a restore. And here's the key right here. The backup compression is off by default, but choose Compress Backup. Click Next again. And the cleanup task is we want to make sure that we don't keep databases over a week, because frankly, you don't want to use them. They're going to be so outdated, you're going to have difficulty in getting a restore to work properly. And the other thing is just to save, especially in case if you have very large databases, it gives you the ability to clean them up so that you can keep them fresh. So we put in the file type of BAK. Don't make the mistake of adding a period in front of it. It won't work. Include the first level subfolders, and then we're going to only retain 1 week's worth of history. Click Next again. Next again. And at this point, if I click Finish, it will save it, and then the only other thing that we have to do is set up a schedule. Okay? It creates a SQL Server agent task. I'm going to click out of that because this has already been completed. And we'll end up with a job like this. Now, if I run it, I can start the job. And what it will do in the background is back up all of the databases that I've selected to the backups folder, and it will add them in succession. And I think it's almost done. And there's a step-by-step, by the way, on my blog, which I'll post the link at the end of this, so you can experiment with this. The next thing I want to show you is, okay, if you had a failure, how would you recover? So what I'd like to do is simulate a, whoops, my database is gone. So we're going to select the Configuration Manager database. And if you do this in your lab, make sure that you have to choose Close Existing Connections, the bottom one. Don't do it in production. We'll click OK. And there, now the database is gone. Thank you very much. So I have you can use either a restore wizard from the interface, or you can just simply use the restore database command, which is highlighted below. And again, I can share these scripts with you, not a problem. So what I'll do is I'll launch this, which will restore a previous backup made this morning. And as that's running, I'm going to run the setup wizard in the background. And we have to run setup in order to do restore. So while that's going, I'll launch the setup. And you can see the database restore finished. So the wizard walks us through. We choose next. And note that it is context sensitive in that it recognizes that Configuration Manager is previously installed on this device. So notice that a lot of these are grayed out. But it comes right here to recover a site. We choose next. And at this point, we can use a site database that has been, we're going to select this option, use a site database that has been manually recovered. And note what's interesting and is an important point is that for either of these other options, such as recover the database using a backup set, which was created using a maintenance wizard, what will happen in the background, it will actually copy the database files back and the backup INI, but it basically leaves all those other files behind. It doesn't use the inbox files. So there's, in my opinion, there's really no reason to copy those if you're running SP1 and later. So we choose the manually restored database, click Next again, accept the license terms. And similarly to an install, we have to go through and choose the prereqs, which I've already downloaded. And this restore and my discussion today is primarily designed around single site hierarchies. If you do have a multi-site hierarchy and want to know how to restore it, but feel free to contact me after. There are some nuances that you need to know. So we take the defaults again for the database information. Note that if you've moved the database files, you have the opportunity to choose a different path. And here's our build out for our restore. Click Next again. And it does a standard prerequisite check to make sure everything's okay. And then we begin install. This process takes between 2 or 3 minutes. So at this point, I'm going to switch over to talk about PowerShell. So this particular script is based on some best practices in terms of polling different items within SQL Server, and you'll note that I've designed it so that really the only thing you have to change. Let me zoom in. Is the first few lines here. We've got the SQL Server itself, which would be the NetBIOS name of the server or FQDN. Note that if you're dealing with a SQL Server instance, you'd use the server name slash instance, and then the Configuration Manager database name, and then temp. And what it does is, and I've got it commented here, it creates and opens a new connection to SQL Server using integrated security. And then the next step is query by query, it will populate the variable. Next step is it creates a new command, a SQL command object, and then it sets the properties for the SQL command. And then finally, we set up a data adapter object. And then what happens here is that once this executes, we have a data set filled with the information that we brought back from our query. And then at the end of each one of these steps, what we do is pipe it out to a CSV file. What I'm going to do is launch this in the background, and I'll explain the rest of it. So as this is running, it queries, and it's running in the temp folder, tempdb. And you'll see it populates all of these different items. And then as a final step, what I've done is integrate a PowerShell that basically takes those CSV files, pulls them into an Excel spreadsheet. So then you have the ability to have a nice handy document. Somewhere down around the 15th query, what I do is I switch the context of the connection here, and I illustrated it as part two. Notice what we do is basically set up a new connection using the Configuration Manager database, because I want to get additional properties from that, such as what are the size of the files, what are other specifics in terms of the performance. I'm looking for indexes that are severely fragmented, that kind of thing. And then the other item I want to show you is this VLF information. And since what I'd like to do now is come back and show you the Excel spreadsheet that was created as a result of this, each one of the items that were exported ends up creating a single tab. So we have overall server properties. One of the things I typically, and I'll go through some of these things right now, but the version information is important because if the server, SQL Server needs security updates and patches and cumulative updates, just like Windows. So it's one of the things I'll look at to see if perhaps that needs to be addressed. It also gives me the SQL Server install date. Some other key things, database properties. This is for the server itself. One of the first things I'll do when I open this one is if I look at the recovery model, and if it's a default installation, you probably find that report server is set up in full recovery mode, which means that it's continually logging. And I've seen report servers and SUSDB that are absolutely huge. And part of that is because the recovery mode should be set to simple. So it's just another quick check, kind of a sanity check. A few other things I want to show you are the log file free space, number 14. This is another useful one because sometimes in very large production environments, your log files can grow very large and then start churning. What you want to make sure is that your log file has enough free space to allow for growth without automatically expanding. In fact, auto growth is another thing that I'd like to add to this. So my suggestion is as you start looking through these, and if you have any suggestions, by all means, send me feedback. You know, I'd like to grow this, and I've actually came up with a few other ideas. The VLF is the last thing I want, and I'm almost out of time, is that virtual log file means that as the temporary transactional log file grows, it grows and creates these virtual log files. The impact of VLFs over 50 or so is that it affects write performance. Things start slowing down. And startup and shutdown times start taking longer and longer. And there's a way to correct that as well. And even this little temporary virtual environment, I've got something like 184 or 5 virtual log files, which is pretty large considering. So it's really easy to get that to grow. But frankly, I'm out of time. And I want to thank you all for being here. Greg, any closing remarks?
All right, great session, guys. Really appreciate it. 6 o'clock, the room is still practically full. This is good stuff. Really glad you took the time out of your schedule to be here. We're all going to be out in the hall if anybody wants to chat afterwards. Meet each other, talk to your ConfigMan admin, share your war stories. We've got them too. Take care. Thanks.
All right, thank you.